This episode features discussions of kidnapping, rape, extreme sexual sadism, and violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. March 1981. 24-year-old Colleen Stan sat in a hot car idling in the driveway of her father's Riverside, California home. She was nervous. She hadn't been home since she was abducted nearly 4 years earlier. Next to her sat the man who had kidnapped her and made her his slave, Cameron Hooker.
He pointed to a nearby trailer. He reminded Colleen that if she revealed to anyone that she was being held captive, men from the company would swarm her father's house and kill her family.
Colleen tried to swallow the lump in her throat.
For years, Cameron had fed her stories about an all-powerful group of slavers known as the Company, who would torture and kill any slave who ran away from their owner.
The thought of Colleen's family being put through the same sadistic torture she had endured was unbearable. Colleen swore that she wouldn't reveal the truth, no matter what.
With that, Cameron Hooker allowed Colleen to approach her father's house alone. She would stay the weekend before getting back in the car with Cameron, returning to his dungeon of terrors. This is Hostage, the Parcast original telling the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We also cover the psychological tactics used by kidnappers and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can listen to all of Parcast's shows on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. New episodes come out every Thursday.
At Parcast, we're thankful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
This is our final episode on the kidnapping of Colleen Stan, a 20-year-old woman who was abducted while hitchhiking on May 19, 1977, and held for 7 years as a sex slave by husband and wife duo Cameron and Janice Hooker.
Colleen was kept in a coffin-like box in the basement for 23 hours a day, only taken out so that Cameron could enact sadistic sexual fantasies on her each night.
Last week, we followed Colleen as she was systematically tortured and brainwashed into believing that an all-powerful group of slavers known as the Company was watching her every move, preventing her from escaping.
We also met Janice Hooker, Cameron's abused wife, who had a tumultuous relationship with Colleen, whom she saw as her husband's other woman.
This week, we'll examine Colleen's weekend trip home to her family and her willing return to the Hooker household in Red Bluff, California, where she continued to be held as a slave. We'll also follow her unlikely ally.
By March 1981, Colleen Stan had been captive for nearly 4 years. She was growing accustomed to living in near constant terror. Likewise, she had learned to appreciate the small freedoms Cameron allowed her. He would let her stay home alone when they needed a babysitter for their two small children. She was allowed to jog around the block to get some fresh air. A few times, he let her call home.
It's unclear why Cameron would begin allowing Colleen privileges, but according to psychiatrist Neil Burton, Cameron may have developed Lima syndrome.
Lima syndrome is the inverse of Stockholm syndrome, wherein a captor develops an emotional attachment to their hostage. But any good graces that Cameron extended to Colleen were undercut by the unending torture she endured.
She still spent the majority of her time blindfolded and naked, stuffed in a wood coffin beneath the Hooker's waterbed. Every night she was taken out of the box and tortured as Hooker fed his insatiable sadistic fetishes.
In early 1981, Cameron came to Colleen with a shocking proposition. He would allow Colleen to spend a weekend at home with her family on one condition. She had to pass a loyalty test.
With Cameron, there was always a catch. But Colleen warily agreed.
He blindfolded her, put a shotgun in her mouth, and ordered her to pull the trigger.
Colleen's heart began to race. She had no idea whether or not the gun was loaded.
All she knew for sure was that if Cameron ever wanted to kill her, this is exactly how he'd do it. Get her hopes up, then make her kill herself. He'd find it funny.
But truthfully, if she couldn't see her family, she didn't want to live. It was terrifying, but it wasn't a hard choice. Colleen pulled the trigger.
The gun was empty. Colleen was going home.
On Friday, March 20th, 1981, Cameron and Colleen began the long drive to Colleen's father's home in Southern California.
As they drove, Cameron instructed Colleen on what to say to her family. He told her the company had tapped the entire house and would be listening in. As they turned off the highway into Riverside, Colleen felt jitters rush through her. It had been 4 years since she'd seen her family.
Colleen's father's house was on a quiet, blue-collar street with well-groomed lawns. Cameron idled in the driveway, giving Colleen final instructions on what to say when her family asked her where she'd been for 4 years. Cameron left her at the door, telling her he'd be back in 2 days.
Colleen's family greeted her with hugs and kisses. It was a kind of affection she hadn't felt in years. Waves of relief washed over her as she embraced her parents and sister. It felt weird to be called Colleen instead of the slave name Cameron had given her, the letter K.
And yet, Colleen did not feel safe. She knew that every moment she spent in the house put her family at risk. The company was listening, after all. She couldn't tell them where she had been or risk their torture and death.
Yet her family found it hard to ignore Colleen's pale, sickly appearance, her homemade clothes and gaunt face. They later confessed that they assumed she had fallen in with a cult, which were prevalent in California in the 1970s and 80s.
Finally, Colleen's sister Bonnie worked up the nerve to ask Colleen why she hadn't written.
Colleen said, "I didn't have the money to buy stamps or make a phone call. I was too busy working, babysitting for a family, and working in their garden."
The Stans took this as a tacit confession that their daughter was in a cult. They felt abandoned. A barrier formed between them.
One that Colleen shared. As much as she loved her family, she couldn't help but feel like they had forgotten about her. Why hadn't they come looking?
Of course, she had no way of knowing that 4 years earlier, in the summer of 1977, the family had driven up and down the coast looking for her. They filed a missing persons report. They stopped at every police department along the way, any town she might have hitchhiked through, but she hadn't left a trace.
Both parties, it seemed, were operating under the emotional impact of rejection.
According to author and academic Judith E. Glaser, the emotional impact of rejection activates the same neural pathways as physical pain. Even on her weekend away from Cameron's abuse, Colleen couldn't escape being hurt.
Late that night, Colleen came close to telling her sister about Cameron Hooker, but she thought of the company and stopped short. She couldn't risk subjecting Bonnie to the sexual slavery.
The next day, March 21st, 1981, Colleen was supposed to spend the full day with her family and had planned on going to church and catching up with distant relatives. Instead, Cameron called the house and told Colleen he would be there in 10 minutes to pick her up.
Colleen was gutted. She had expected an entire weekend with her family. 24 hours hadn't been enough. Cameron soon appeared at the door and introduced himself as Colleen's fiancé, Mike. He told the family he and Colleen were in the process of moving to Oregon, but would have to come back for a visit once they were settled.
But Bonnie didn't buy it. She followed her stepmother Ruth into the kitchen and told her something was wrong. Bonnie wasn't letting Colleen leave. She would block the door with her body if she had to.
But Ruth shook her head and warned Bonnie that if they pushed Colleen away, she might never come back. It didn't matter what they thought of Mike. For now, if he made Colleen happy, they had to accept him.
Bonnie agreed through gritted teeth and said goodbye to her sister.
Colleen got back in the car, and Cameron Hooker drove them away.
The car ride home was silent. Colleen's mind was racing with things she wished she'd said to her family. She wondered whether she would ever see them again.
Cameron, too, found himself preoccupied, but his worries were far more sinister.
He worried that Colleen had slipped a note to someone or ratted him out.
Or perhaps Bonnie, who visibly disliked him, had jotted down his license plate number. Cameron panicked. He needed to reestablish dominance over his slave.
When they arrived in Red Hook, Cameron put her back in the box. They quickly fell back into the old torture routine. 23 hours in the box, 1 hour for food and torture. Colleen came to realize why the company had threatened her family. If it was only her life on the line, she would have taken that option a long time ago.
Colleen expected for Cameron to eventually ease up, to give her the old privileges back. But something about the weekend away had shaken him.
As months passed, Colleen slowly began to realize that there would be no reprieve. The box was the entirety of her life now.
In fact, no one, not even the Hooker's children, would see Colleen Stan for another 3 years.
In a moment, Colleen makes a request that changes her life forever. Now back to the story.
One wonders, as the Hooker children grew, if they ever thought about the babysitter who used to play with them. They had no idea that from 1981 to 1984, that woman was right upstairs, trapped in a small box beneath their parents' bed.
After allowing Colleen a weekend with her family in March 1981, Cameron got spooked. He shoved Colleen into the box beneath his bed and never gave her free rein of the house again.
And even more horrifically, his violent fantasies escalated. He dreamed up even more perverted ways of torturing Colleen. And unfortunately for her, Cameron was a skilled woodworker, more than capable of making these fantasies a reality.
Hooker built a contraption he dubbed the Stretcher. It worked like a medieval torture device. He tied Colleen to two heavy boards and turned a winch, stretching the board apart. He would watch with pleasure as Colleen's entire body tightened and she screamed in agony.
He would keep her on the stretcher as long as she could stand, choking her and watching her writhe. Then he'd lock her in the box until it was time for another session.
One day in 1982, while Cameron was at work and Janice was away, Colleen broke. She flew into a fit of rage. It had been almost 2 years since she'd last been allowed out of her box. She began screaming, kicking, and flailing against the wood box. She railed on it as hard as she could.
Suddenly, the foot of the box collapsed. Colleen was stunned. She had kicked it open. She went to get up, to flee this wretched house that had filled her nightmares for 6 years. But she stopped. The company was watching.
When Cameron returned, Colleen expected to be whipped for damaging the box. But he simply began repairing the door. In fact, he seemed proud. She had the chance to escape, but out of fear, she had stayed. It was what Cameron had always dreamed of. With a thin-lipped smile, he tucked Colleen back in the box for safekeeping.
Dr. Amy Baker, a psychologist at Columbia University, has written that victims of abduction tend to internalize physical restraints to such an extent that the victim becomes psychologically dependent on their abuser. The abuser looms so large in the victim's mind, they cannot imagine ever breaking free.
With the help of the imaginary company, Cameron had become such a beast. Colleen could no longer imagine a world without him looming in the shadows, waiting for a moment to recapture her.
That same year, Cameron and Janice Hooker were gripped by a new passion, the Holy Bible.
Janice was the first of the two to find religion. In many ways, she was a captive herself. Since marrying Cameron at 17, Janice had been subject to sadistic bondage and torture. She had hoped that he would take out the worst of his sadistic urges on Colleen instead of on her, but she had misjudged.
Even with Colleen, Cameron still practiced violent bondage on Janice, often treating her worse than he treated Colleen. She felt powerless to stop it.
Growing up, Janice had been told by her parents that she was unattractive and dim-witted. They never showed her love, and she developed crippling anxiety that kept her bound to Cameron. At the same time, she was deathly afraid of him.
In fact, Janice believed that if she ever tried to leave, Cameron would literally kill her. He told her as much on many occasions. He once threatened her with a knife. She felt trapped by her marriage and terrified of the larger world.
So it's little wonder that Janice felt the need to believe in something beyond her little world. God provided such an outlet. She began reading the Bible by herself every night. Soon, Cameron asked Janice to read it aloud.
Janice read the entire New Testament to Cameron while they sat in bed together, with Colleen in a box just beneath them. It leaves one to wonder what Colleen might have thought were she able to hear the Bible being read aloud.
But from her sound and light-proof coffin, she could only hear her own thoughts.
Prayer had gotten Colleen through much of her ordeal, and she knew the Bible somewhat well. But Cameron was far more interested in cherry-picking the sections that supported his cryptic worldview.
He was especially interested in the parts of the Bible that dealt with master-slave relationships and how a wife should be obedient to her husband. And there were many examples. The books of Corinthians, Ephesians, and Colossians all deal with the treatment of slaves and obedient wives. Cameron was overjoyed.
He gleefully began reminding Janice that if she wasn't submissive, she would burn in hell for eternity. Cameron soon even had a favorite Bible story, that of Sarah and Hagar.
The story goes that when Abraham's wife Sarah was unable to bear him children, she volunteered her female slave Hagar to sleep with him so that he could have children with her. Cameron saw this as an example of how their unorthodox family unit was, in fact, based on the Bible.
Of course, both Janice and Colleen knew that Cameron was twisting the Bible to fit his own ends. But without other options, they were forced to play along.
And in a weird way, the forced solidarity created a strained friendship between the two women.
On one occasion, Janice came down with the flu, and Colleen was let out of the box to take care of her, a freedom she had rarely been extended since her weekend home. When Janice felt better, she sent Colleen a thank you card that read, "To Hagar, from Sarah."
Late in 1983, things began to slowly change for Colleen. Since her trip to visit her family in Riverside 2.5 years prior, she had been kept in the box nearly 24 hours a day. She filled her mind with fantasies about the future, daydreaming about the kind of house that she would one day live in and the family she would have. She planned every detail of her future life, down to the color of her picket fence. She stayed mentally withdrawn, blocking out her reality as best she could.
But over time, Cameron began to feel safe that Colleen wouldn't run, and Janice no longer felt threatened by another woman in the house. Rather, she had come to see Colleen as a very odd sort of friend.
Colleen's years of silent obedience had won her a place as an accepted member of the household. Cameron began seeing her as a second wife.
He began feeding her twice a day so that she wouldn't look so gaunt. He told her that he planned to reintroduce her to the world. Soon, Colleen was also reintroduced to the Hookers' two young daughters, Charity and Amber.
Mind you, Charity and Amber had no idea that Colleen had been in the house all this time. So they were surprised and excited when their old babysitter began showing up again. Colleen was elated to be put in charge of babysitting again.
It had been 3 years since Colleen had seen them, and she was shocked at how big they had gotten. When she was put back in the box after visiting Riverside, the girls were 3 and 5. Now they were 6 and 8.
In December 1983, Colleen celebrated her 27th birthday. For the first time in 6 years, Cameron acknowledged it and even got her a cake. Colleen nervously thanked Cameron and built up the courage to ask him for something, to be allowed to go out in public and get a job.
Cameron stared at Colleen, inscrutable. Colleen wondered if he was angry. She began to worry. She felt that she had reached too far. She panicked, thinking she was about to be put back in the box. Cameron quietly said that he would think on it and change the subject. Colleen felt like she dodged a bullet.
Meanwhile, Colleen kept gaining freedoms around the house. In May of 1984, Colleen spent her last night trapped inside the box. She was cooking for the family again, babysitting and gardening. She loved the sunshine, but more than anything, she was thankful that she was now allowed to sleep in the back bathroom.
Janice learned that Colleen was also religious and began coming to Colleen to read and study the Bible together. They started having actual conversations, and slowly, something like a friendship developed between them.
But while Colleen was enjoying her new relative freedom, Janice was suffering more than ever. She realized that Colleen, her slave, was her best friend.
It's not clear why, but between late 1983 and 1984, Janice became the main target of Cameron's sadistic bondage. He'd always tortured Janice once or twice a month throughout their marriage, but now the torture was weekly, sometimes even more frequent.
Distraught, Janice sought help from a local pastor. She described her situation in murky details, so the pastor was confused. He thought Janice was saying that her husband was cheating on her. He told Janice to go home and work harder to smooth things out with her husband. After all, it was her godly duty to stand by him. Janice felt hopeless.
But for whatever reason, she got a second opinion, this time from a Catholic priest down the road. She described her circumstances, and the priest told her that in no uncertain terms, her three-party marriage was ungodly. His words relieved her in a way that she had not been expecting. After years of pent-up frustration, it was like someone had hit the release valve.
She had long suspected that Cameron was twisting the Bible to his own ends, but now she trusted her judgment. Janice still didn't have the strength to leave Cameron. How would she care for her children alone? Plus, she was still worried Cameron would kill her.
But her anxiety grew overwhelming. One day, while Cameron was at work, Janice broke down. She told Colleen that she was going to leave Cameron.
Colleen was terrified. Not only would that mean that all of Cameron's aggression would be pinpointed at her, it also meant certain death for Janice.
Colleen reminded Janice of the company. She said, "We can't go. They'll find us and torture us."
Janice looked at Colleen and started to speak, but stopped herself. She nodded. Colleen took it to mean that Janice remembered that she too was trapped, but in reality, Janice was overcome with guilt. She still couldn't bring herself to tell Colleen the truth about the company.
And she still couldn't find the strength to leave Cameron. She was so depressed she could barely function. Colleen was her only friend, and she couldn't even muster the courage to tell her that the company was fake. If she found out, Colleen could leave whenever she wanted.
Janice came to believe her parents had been right. She was weak, she was out of options, and unable to help herself. In her despair, she took the only escape route she could think of. She asked Cameron to kill her.
To Colleen's horror, Cameron agreed, far too enthusiastically.
He wrapped his hands around Janice's bird-like neck and began to squeeze.
It was a sensation Janice knew well. She had felt it countless times during Cameron's torture sessions. As light and sound faded away, Janice began to gurgle and her veins popped out. But just as she was about to die, Cameron released his grip. She dropped to the floor as Cameron looked down on her with a malicious grin.
He wasn't going to let her escape that easily.
Next, Janice finally finds courage. Now, back to the story. In early 1984, Janice Hooker asked her husband Cameron to kill her. She felt it was her only way out of the nightmare she had been living through the past 7 years, but Cameron refused.
Instead, he called their slave, Colleen, into the living room.
Colleen was terrified. She bowed in front of Cameron like she had been taught to and awaited whatever sadistic order he was about to give.
Instead, Cameron told her, "God said you can go out into the world and get a job."
Colleen was floored, but she knew better than to press for details. She thanked Cameron and hurried out of the room.
She couldn't believe her good fortune. After 7 years trapped in this house, she was headed back into the world.
In May of 1984, Cameron drove Colleen around Red Bluff, California to apply for jobs.
She was dropped off at a motel advertising help wanted. Nervously, Colleen walked inside and spoke with the motel manager. 10 minutes later, Colleen returned to the car with a smile on her face. She had been hired on the spot as a maid.
Colleen felt like all her prayers had been answered. No longer was she being kept inside the box all night. She was allowed to cook, garden, and babysit the children. Now, she even had a job. She was rebuilding the life Cameron had taken from her.
Colleen worked hard at the motel and was soon promoted to working the front desk. Although she was quiet, she was a perfectionist. Her years of obeying Cameron meant that each job she was tasked with was done quickly and to the best of her ability.
To her coworkers, Colleen was a normal employee, even if they found it odd when she mentioned that she slept on the floor at the Hooker's house, or how she signed over her paychecks to Cameron and was granted a $20 allowance in return. Still, no one raised an eyebrow.
At the same time, in the summer of 1984, Janice grew increasingly agitated. She was afraid that Cameron might someday begin abusing her two young daughters. She went to a new pastor and tacitly described her concerns.
The pastor told Janice she was living in sin and had to leave. He told her that she was capable of making it on her own, a sentiment that Janice had never heard before. She felt a strength well up inside her and became resolute. She had to escape. But first, she had to reveal the truth to Colleen.
On August 9th, 1984, Colleen was working at the King's Lodge Motel as a maid, cleaning a motel room, when she received a surprise visit from Janice.
Janice was red-eyed, as if she had been crying. She asked Colleen if she could tell her something. Colleen and Janice sat down in the guest room, and Janice took a breath. She was ready to reveal the secret she'd been keeping from Colleen for 7 years.
Janice said, "Cameron lied to you about everything. The company, the slavery contract, all that he told you was just lies. He lied to scare you, to make you his slave."
Colleen felt dizzy. She grappled with what Janice was saying as the past 7 years flashed before her. 7 wasted years. She could feel rage simmering inside of her. Tears began to stream down her face. She wanted to be furious with Janice, but she couldn't bring herself to it. She knew Janice suffered as much as she did. The two women held each other and wept.
The secret was over. The chains were off. All the fear that had been keeping Colleen a prisoner evaporated. She was free to go.
But it wasn't that easy. Cameron would be home soon, and both women feared that, should they escape, he might find and kill them. Besides, they couldn't leave without the children.
They weighed their options and devised a plan.
The next day, after Cameron went to work, they would take the children and flee.
Colleen and Janice returned to Cameron Hooker's home for what they hoped would be their last night in this hellhole. They did their best to make it seem like everything was normal. They ate dinner like a family.
The next day, Cameron left for work at the break of dawn. Colleen and Janice collected the two young girls and their few possessions and hurried to the car, praying none of the neighbors had seen them. Then they fled to Janice's father's house.
From there, Colleen called her father and asked him to wire her some money for a bus ticket home.
Colleen's father was ecstatic to hear from her. It had been over 3 years. He offered to send her extra money, anything she needed, but she said all she needed was $100 and she'd be home.
But it wasn't that easy. Janice had never really been on her own, and the thought of Colleen leaving scared her. She begged Colleen not to go. She promised that with help, Cameron would change his ways and the five of them could be a family once more.
Colleen looked over Janice's terrified face, the worry lines that had etched themselves across her forehead, and agreed not to go to the police. But that was the last kindness she could offer.
With that, Colleen Stan left Janice Hooker behind.
Colleen made it to the bus station, but something nagged at her, a final item on the long-standing to-do list. While she waited for her bus, she made a call.
Cameron answered. Colleen took a deep breath and said, "I'm leaving. I know you lied about everything, and you can't keep me here anymore."
She expected a violent reaction. Maybe he would even try to make it to the bus station to stop her. But instead, Cameron began weeping.
Colleen hung up the phone and got on the bus. Janice, on the other hand, couldn't make such a clean break. Her parents didn't understand the full extent of why Janice had left and assumed they were having normal marital problems. They convinced Janice to go back to Cameron, and within a week, she had moved back in.
Janice's singular moment of clarity had saved Colleen's life, but the voices of doubt that swarmed in her own head were too loud. Janice didn't believe she could make it on her own.
Colleen, too, was finding it hard to extricate the Hookers from her life.
After arriving at her father's house in Riverside, California, Colleen's family demanded to know where she had been. Colleen revealed the basic details of what had happened, but her family didn't understand.
Colleen immediately set about finding a job and was soon hired in the housekeeping department at a local hospital. But she had difficulty adjusting to life as a free woman. For years, Janice had been her only friend, so she kept speaking with her on the phone at least once a day.
She also had several conversations with Cameron himself. Most were mundane. Cameron once called Colleen at her father's house to ask how to make a tuna sandwich.
Her family pleaded with her to go to the police, but Colleen had made her promise to Janice. On September 19, 1984, about a month after she'd escaped, Colleen wrote Cameron and Janice a letter that said, "I forgive you and Cameron for all things. It's done."
According to author and Oxford psychiatrist Dr. Neil Burton, capture bonding, the emotional connection underlying Stockholm syndrome, is evolutionarily derived. Because much of human history has been played out in hunter-gatherer societies, abductions, particularly of women and children, have been very common. Capture bonding is an adaptive trait that promotes survival in times of war and strife. This explains why, even after escaping, Colleen maintained communication with the hookers. She still felt close to them, even though she was free.
With Colleen gradually separating from their lives, Janice found herself praying that Cameron would finally change for good. For his part, he promised her that he would. He burned most of his hardcore bondage pornography, along with his whips and the gas mask.
But soon, Janice found new bondage magazines piling up. 10 years of marriage had taught her what it meant. Cameron was planning to kidnap another girl.
This time, Janice was resolute. She packed up her daughters and left Cameron for good. On November 7th, 1984, terrified that Cameron might retaliate, Janice went to her pastor and finally revealed in detail the horrific secrets that she had been bottling up for years. The pastor was outside his depth. With Janice's permission, he picked up the phone and called the Tehama County Sheriff's Office.
The police came and interviewed Janice, who was on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
Surprisingly, when Janice confessed, it wasn't just the kidnapping and abduction of Colleen that was troubling her conscience. Instead, she was haunted by something she'd never spoken of before, a murder that Cameron had covered up.
Janice told the police that in January of 1976, a year before she and Cameron abducted Colleen, they had picked up another girl, Marie Elizabeth Spanicky. Like Colleen, Cameron had taken her to his basement and practiced sadistic bondage on her. When Marie began screaming, Cameron cut out her vocal cords with a knife. Hours later, Marie bled to death.
The police were slow to believe Janice's story at first, but soon found that a 19-year-old girl named Marie Elizabeth Spanicky had indeed disappeared from Chico, California on that date, and no evidence about her disappearance was ever found.
Still not believing the incredible story that Janice was telling them about Cameron Hooker, the police went to Colleen Stan. They found her at her father's house, where Colleen lucidly and calmly backed up Janice's claims. The police were shocked and asked Colleen why she hadn't gone to the police. She said simply because Janice had asked her not to.
Police arrested Cameron on November 18, 1984. He was incredibly polite and pretended not to know what the problem was. If it weren't for two witness testimonies, the police might have believed the facade. He had no police record, not so much as a traffic ticket. From the outside, Cameron Hooker was a model citizen.
The lead detective told Cameron they had a warrant to search his property and asked Cameron for the keys to the back shed. Cameron handed the keys over. The lead detective noticed a second, smaller key on Cameron's keyring. He recognized it immediately. It belonged to a set of handcuffs.
In the weeks that followed, news of Colleen's ordeal found its way to the media, who dubbed her the girl in the box. The wire services picked up on it, and soon Red Bluff was swarmed with reporters.
Ultimately, Cameron Hooker was arraigned on multiple sexual assaults and kidnapping charges. Because investigators were unable to find any physical evidence linking him to the murder of Marie Elizabeth Spanicky, and without a body, no murder charge was ever brought.
A lengthy trial followed, in which serious doubts were cast on Colleen's story. Newspaper articles wondered how she could have been a hostage when she had access to physical freedom and a phone. Colleen had been gardening, jogging, and even gone on family vacations with the hookers.
Cameron's defense team showed the letter Colleen wrote to Cameron in 1980, in which she said that she loved him. It was a serious blow to her credibility, and Colleen was left wondering if Cameron Hooker would escape scot-free.
But thankfully, the prosecution's evidence was infallible. They presented the jury with Colleen's signed slave contract, photos of Colleen and Janice being tortured, and even recreated the coffin-like box in exacting detail, inviting the jury to each take a turn lying inside and experience the horrifying claustrophobia for themselves.
Cameron Hooker was found guilty, with a judge referring to him as the most dangerous psychopath ever encountered. He was sentenced to 104 years in Corcoran State Prison, and in 2015, he was denied parole for the first time. Today, Cameron Hooker is 65 years old and is eligible for parole again in 2022.
After the trial, Janice divorced Cameron. Today, she lives in Northern California working with troubled teens.
Colleen now lives under a different name in an undisclosed part of California. In 2008, she published a book about her ordeal called The Simple Gifts of Life.
In it, she discusses what, for many, was the most confusing part about her story: the affectionate letters she wrote to Cameron, the way she lied for him to her family, and the relationship she had with the hookers after her escape.
She talks about the lengths she was willing to go to survive, and cautions that anyone in a similar situation would act as gentle to their captors. She even goes as far as to say that they should change the name of Stockholm Syndrome to Survivor's Syndrome. Because at the end of the day, that's all it is: the will to survive at any cost. Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Andy Waits, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Liebeskin. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. This episode of Hostage was written by Scott Hipp and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.